The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 614 for Monday, July 18th, 2016. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show. Are you sending questions, tips, and cool stuff found? We share it all. We answer the questions. And together, we all like to learn a whole lot new about what's going on. And specifically, we like to make sure we each learn at least three new things. I'm lowering the bar back to three only because we got to get back into our rhythm here because we've had kind of a couple of weeks off, even though we've been releasing shows. Sponsors for this episode include Otherworld Computing at MacSales.com. Make sure to check them out. We'll talk more about them later. And Barebones Software with BB Edit at Barebones.com. We'll talk more about them here, back in Durham, New Hampshire. I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here, preparing for severe thunderstorms, as you are, I believe.
Actually, I'm not preparing. I'm just suffering through them while we're recording. So you can have them.
Gosh. Yeah. But here in Fairfield, Connecticut, this is John F. Braun.
How you doing, Mr. John F. Braun?
I'm doing as well as can be expected.
Well, I guess that's good. Yeah. So as we mentioned in the last two episodes that we kind of pre-recorded ahead of time and all of that, I was just in Europe for 2 weeks with Lisa and the kids. It was a family trip to three destinations. In fact, we were in London, Barcelona, and then Paris, and just got back late last night. So I'm still, you know, it's easier coming back time wise, of course, than it is going over. That just seems to be universally true. But
what was the term you used for the language you eventually, because, all right, so obviously in the UK,
they speak a different language.
Well, they speak proper English, not American English.
Yeah. They make up some words, though. They speak a language closer to ours than any of the other places.
I don't think they make up words. They just have different terms for things. And, you know, the thing is, I got to say, if you haven't listened to it, folks, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the original BBC radio broadcast, I learned so many Britishisms, I'm going to call them.
Yeah, sure.
You know, the chemist, zebra crossings. So many terms that... You know, we don't say here, they say over there, but and it's just a hilarious series. And our friend Douglas Adams, was actually, when they had this program, an Apple master, because he helped write a lot of, you know, cool games based on the series. And it was just a cool guy. I think you and I talked about this day. We met him at one of the Macworld shows.
Here we are on a tangent of a third tangent. It's great, though.
Triple tangent.
No, it's good, right? So when we were in London, the third night we were there, we held a meetup. Now, you mentioned zebra crossings. Our Airbnb was actually down the street from a very, very famous zebra crossing, the one in front of Abbey Road Studios. It just so happened that we were in that neighborhood, but we held a Mac Geek Gab meetup and a bunch of people came and for those that were there, I was trying to remember everyone's name to introduce everyone to everyone else as someone would, you know, arrive. And so Elliot, Joe, Andy, Chris, Rick, Gus, Simon, Ollie, and Paul, I believe, were the names of all of the listeners. And, of course, my family and me were there. But I think I've got them all right. But you, John, were there in spirit. And we talked about your tangents of tangents and how much that adds to what we do here. So it was quite a good time to get together with everybody. And I had some food. They got to watch me eat British food, which they got far more of a kick out of, I think, than I ever expected. And we drank some fine ales at this pub together and just had a great conversation. And it was a good, fun night. So it was good stuff. But
I cannot believe this.
What's that?
I'm sorry. So I'm hearing So Handoff is working on my system here. This is the fourth call. I'm sorry. I think it's somewhat relevant here, but this is the fourth call I've got today. Hello? No, this is the fourth call I've got today. Yeah, we're going. This is the fourth call I've got today from New York City from these people telling me that they're filing a lawsuit against me, IRS. It's like, guys, will you stop? It's the fourth one today. Seriously.
Dude. So you were there because
in
of
spirit,
this.
Yes.
No, it's a perfect example. This is great. And by the time we got back, we had spoken British English. We had been in places where they spoke British English, Spanish, but really more Catalonian in Barcelona. But they also spoke English there. But we Hamiltons are fairly comfortable speaking Spanish because of the kids, and Lisa and I both took it in school. Lisa also took French, but we speak a lot of Spanish at home. So Barcelona, we were able to move around and speak Spanish quite a bit. And then in Paris, none of us speak French. I can read French okay. And actually, after having been there now, I can sort of begin to understand it. The accent really threw me off at first, but now I sort of understand how they form their words, and it's better. So we had a good time. I wanted to go through a couple of things, though, John, if I may, that I learned during our travels.
Mac related?
Tech and Apple and Mac related. Yes. Yeah. So
outstanding.
Worldwide data is a pain in the neck. Thank you very much to everyone that sort of steered us and helped us, and especially Mike for getting us SIM cards ahead of time so that we could have everything going. But we used a company called Three, T-H-R-E-E, in the UK, and then they have this what they call feel at home plan. But we had UK numbers. We just put new SIMs in our iPhones. We made sure our iPhones were unlocked before we left, and then we were able to use our data that we purchased for the UK everywhere that we went in Europe, and it worked great. Some of the data service, like in Paris especially, at least the ones that we could roam on, it was sort of weak. It was Orange and one called Free, F-R-E-E, that they were okay, but they weren't great. But worldwide data is a mess, although they're cleaning it up somewhat in Europe. I think they passed some legislation a while back that says...
Now, are they, what, LTE, 3G? I mean, are the standards over there the same that you would access here?
Yeah, but the SIMs and the accounts that we had were only good for 3G and 4G data. So we weren't getting any LTE connections. They have them there. We just weren't... The service that we bought didn't have that, but it was fine. We bought, what was it? I think 12 gigs a piece for about $20 a piece. And that was great, you know, and it was fine. Or 20 British pounds. So that's more than $20, but almost 25 or something like that. So for, you know, about $100, we got data for all of us, and we didn't have to think about it. I mean, 12 gigs is a lot of data to use in 2 weeks. So we just didn't have to think about it. And so it was fine, but it's a mess. It shouldn't be this hard to travel around. U.S. cell companies would have screwed us if we were trying to use like AT&T over there. But so if you're going to travel, do that.
All right. My other question is, so here, so at least you and I think are both fortunate in that because we have cable, our cable companies offer, well, free, if you're a member, Wi-Fi. Plus, there's also a lot of public Wi-Fi. But what was your experience with public Wi-Fi access in Europe?
It was pretty prevalent. I use the American Express Starwood credit card, and I'll talk about credit cards in a minute. But because I have that Starwood credit card, I get free access to Boingo wireless hotspots anywhere in the world. The UK is like lousy with them. They're everywhere. So I could get on Wi-Fi pretty much anywhere I wanted. And the kids could too, because I have, you know, they give you enough accounts or whatever. So it was fine. So yeah, we were able to use Wi-Fi, but we didn't have to worry about it because we had so much more data than we were ever going to use. So, you know, it worked out. It worked out. So let's see, the data is a pain in the neck. I used an app called Launcher, which we've talked about on the show before. And with it, you can do all kinds of things, but it you can really use it in the notification center now. I think it's launcherapp.com. We mentioned it during Cool Stuff Found not that long ago. And one of the things, you can add little app launchers, but you can also add little widgets. And so I had time zone widgets for every time zone that we were going to be in, which was really only two, British summertime and CEST, which I believe is Central European summertime, which is 1 hour off from British summertime, and Barcelona and Paris were on that. So, but I also had Boston and San Francisco in there, and it made it really easy. So I didn't ever have to, you know, like stop to think, wait, what time is it in Boston? What time is it here? I could just look. So using that in Launcher was great. And I put Boston time on my Apple Watch too, as one of the complications on my watch face. So at any time of day, I could just look and say, oh, okay, it's 4 a.m. in Boston. Don't, you know, try to text anybody or anything like that. So that was good. You would appreciate this, John. In the Paris metro, I noticed a woman talking on the phone. We use the metros quite a bit. And the cell service in the Paris metro was outstanding. You could get data pretty much the whole time you were underground, which was great.
Well, you know, I think they're starting the metro, of course, being their public transportation.
Their subway. I mean, there's buses and all that, too. But the metro is the subway.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. They've been doing similar, at least from what I can tell, in Manhattan. And I'm going to differentiate Manhattan from New York City, because New York City is not Manhattan, though.
Mostly people... pedantic, but that's okay. Yes.
But yeah, at least for me, they've been installing in the subways, because of course the subway is underground and there's no access points unless they put them there. And I've noticed that they're making it more and more available. Actually, I've seen signs in a lot of the MTA, which is, you know, the area transportation system. They're like, hey, there's free Wi-Fi here. You want to check
great.
It out?
Yeah. That's
which,
good.
You know, free Wi-Fi is great. You know, for anybody who listens here, for any length of time, but if you haven't, if you're new, hello, welcome. But, if you're going to do public Wi-Fi, you know, certainly consider not doing anything entirely sensitive, or get a VPN. Public
right.
Wi-Fi.
No, of course. Yeah. Yeah. Of course.
Just offering that. But yeah, they're, our trains don't have it. I think Amtrak is working towards it, but our MTA has pretty much given up. The local train system, they pretty much admit they don't know how to successfully deploy Wi-Fi for free.
I wasn't talking about Wi-Fi, though. I was talking about actual cell service.
Data. No, I understand.
Okay. All right, gotcha. Yeah, yeah. There were also lots of pickpockets. In fact, getting on the... And we were warned about pickpockets.
I can't believe you told me... So, now you said a little girl. Now, how... okay. But again, you said a little girl. How young?
So John's alluding to my Twitter and Facebook post. Yeah. So we were warned about pickpockets in both Barcelona and Paris. And yeah, one day in Paris, getting on the metro, she was probably 9. I felt her start to try and reach into my front pocket, and I just whacked her hand away. But yeah, so you got to be aware of that. But the metros were fine. You do a lot of walking underground in Paris to use the metros, far more than the other cities. So we wound up using Uber a bunch in Paris. But man, Uber, I've used Uber in a lot of cities and it works fine. They didn't have it in Barcelona, which was sort of frustrating. And it's because of their laws and crazy things. But in Paris, man, Uber must not be overutilized there, because we would call for an Uber and it was like we had a magic button on our phones to make a car materialize before our eyes. We had a first floor. So now I'm using European terms. Our apartment was one floor above the street. So we had to go down a flight of stairs to get to street level, which in Europe they call first floor apartment. And I couldn't, if I ordered an Uber while we were leaving the apartment, that was too early to order the car. It would be like waiting for us, and the driver would be mildly annoyed that we weren't right there when we walked out the door, you know, when he arrived. So Uber in Paris was outstanding and relatively cheap. You know, I never saw it going to surge pricing or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So Uber worked out really, really well. All their credit cards there are chip, and they took the chip and signature US cards, no problem. You know, they would just, their machines would spit out the thing and you just sign it. That wasn't an issue. All of those machines would take tap to pay cards. Apple Pay, however, worked at only about half of them. It would appear to work. The transaction would begin to start, you know, kind of on the terminal end, and then it would fail. And so but I would take the very same card that I had in Apple Pay and put it in, and it would work just fine. So I don't know what the deal was with Apple Pay, especially in Paris, but basically I didn't use it anywhere in Europe with any degree of frequency. I just pull out my card and put it in the machine.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Because the chip thing, which they called EMV, which I believe stands for Euro something MasterCard Visa, which is the consortium that came up with it, Europe has had for
a long time.
Some countries, decades.
Yeah.
We are way behind the curve on the whole chip thing.
Right.
And it sounds like the NFC thing, they're on about the same level. The one thing I remember, though, is that I remember, especially in Paris, you're talking about floors. The thing that I thought was kind of bizarre and actually kind of satisfying as a, you know, computer guy is you would have floor zero.
Right. It was floor zero, one, two. Well, that makes sense, right? I understand how they got there. It makes sense. Yeah. But
well,
yes.
Here you never see an elevator with a floor zero. And
no, you see floor one. Yeah, which is ground
and
floor.
Oddly enough, I think because of superstition or something else here, you rarely see a floor 13 in a lot of buildings just because, you know, ooh, 13 is bad.
I know. Yeah. It's fine. I enjoy superstition, so I get that. Now, where Apple Pay worked flawlessly, believe it or not, was the London Underground. But also on the buses. So not just the subway, which they call the tube there, but also the buses and everything. And it was brilliant because we didn't have to ever buy a subway pass, and we got the bulk discounts that you would get if you had your own subway pass. You just use Apple Pay, and they say you have to use the same device. So you can't go from using your watch to your phone. It's like once you pick a device that you're going to use, that's what you have to use 100% of the time in order to qualify for the you know, bulk discounts. And that's because even the same credit card gets a different ID number on your watch or versus your phone, even though it's being charged to the same card. It's actually it's a different card number in each device. But that worked flawlessly, and it was great because we just get on, you know, we didn't have to do anything. You just go to get on the tube or on a bus, and you just tap your phone and on you go. So that worked out really, really well. Yelp was not popular Yelp was okay. Sorry, OpenTable was not something we could use in Paris, but we did find an app called The Fork at thefork.com. And no, it does not exist in the States, but it does exist in many European countries. And it was awesome for making restaurant reservations and just finding restaurants. And most of the time, if you just bothered to make a reservation with this app, you'd get like a 20 or sometimes 30% discount off your meal. And these were like, you know, decent places that we were eating. So it's definitely worth checking out if you're traveling to use The Fork. And I'm trying to think of what else here. We mentioned AppTamer in one of the shows recently, John. And so I used it on my laptop the whole time we were gone from AppTamer from St. Clair Software, because it kind of did that CPU nicing and that it managed different processes different ways. Outstanding. Have you been using it?
I've been using it, and honestly, for my typical use. So it also has. So AppTamer is something that can throttle and control apps. You know, as far as the percentage of time that it reports it's done anything important, in my cases, is often 0%. So
well,
that's a nice feature of the software.
You've got to tweak it a little bit to like ratchet down the things that you want it to ratchet down.
No, I get that. They have some default settings. I would say, at least for the way I use my computers, I don't think it's going to offer a lot of value because it self-reports. It says, I've helped save you energy and processor this percent of the time. And for the most part, it comes up and says zero. So the way I have it configured, which is the default, and I understand your point, but the way I have it configured now, it's not doing me any good.
My 2011 Air benefits hugely from this.
Yeah, but then your Air has a
it's older.
Relatively wimpy, like that, 1 point correct. Something gigahertz processor. So in that case,
that's right.
Because you're relatively processor constrained, I can understand that. And,
yeah.
And for that use case, the app, I think, makes sense.
Yeah.
For my machines, which I think have more processor than I probably need, it probably doesn't make sense. But it still looks like a fine app, and it, you know, it's well architected. It reports things. Like I said, it reports, hey, I did this useful thing for you this percent of the time, and in my case, it says zero. So yeah. I'm like, okay.
So I used DS Photo the whole time we were there, John, which is the app, the iOS app that links back to the Synology Photo Station. And I used it on my phone and also my wife's phone to just back up our photos every night that we took with our phones all day. And the cool part about it is you can set multiple geofences. So as we got to a new apartment, you know, we used Airbnb for each of the three cities that we were in. And as we got to a new apartment, I would set up, or we would set up geofences for our phones in that place so that every time we got back at night and it joined the Wi-Fi there, it would be like, awesome, great. And it would just start backing up our photos in the background. So if anything were to happen to our phones or anything like that, at least we had our photos that we had been taking, you know, throughout the weekend or the 2 weeks backed up here to the disk station. And then, of course, the disk station here backs up to CrashPlan and everything's hunky dory. So that was that actually, you know, we've been talking a lot about obviously Synology last week. And then in general, we talked about disk station or rolling your own photo cloud. And that worked brilliantly. So I wanted to share that. And it was nice because we could kind of browse each other's photos and because we gave each other permission, obviously. And it worked out well. And lastly, I want to give I want to answer the question that you asked in the pre-show, John. Yes, we connected through Reykjavik, Iceland, coming home. Iceland Air has a lot of flights to and from Europe. We paid cash for our flights coming home. Going over, we used mileage to get to London. It just didn't make sense to use mileage coming home. So we paid cash and wound up booking with Iceland Air. And we went from Paris to Reykjavik and then Reykjavik to Boston. And they're a fantastic airline. We bought, you know, cheap economy seats. We weren't in any special status or anything. The seats were basically as big as like American Airlines extra legroom seats. Very comfortable planes, very nice, good food on the plane. And what was interesting is they are the reason that we wound up going to Barcelona. We were only going to do 2 weeks or two different cities in the 2 weeks. And we booked our flights home from Paris. And they, as soon as we booked them, they said, great, you're booked. Everything's golden. Here's the thing. We'd love to have you stay in Iceland a little bit longer. So if you want to change the time of your first flight or your second flight, we won't charge you anything to make changes. And you could change it by up to a week in either direction. And then you can visit, you know, Iceland and Reykjavik and all this stuff. And we started thinking about, whoa, that's interesting. And then, of course, we thought, well, if we're going to do a third city, Reykjavik probably isn't at the top of our list. And that's how Barcelona kind of came about. And that's why we stuck Barcelona in the middle between those two. Geographically, it doesn't really make sense. But it worked out well. Barcelona is a great place to go and just kind of chill out between the other two cities that we did. So it worked. But Iceland Air, I highly recommend them. So that's all I got, John, I think. I don't know. You got cool. Anything else on this? Any questions? I'm looking at my one thing, because this blew my mind. We went to Liverpool one day and took the train there and back in the same day. It's about a 2-hour train ride each way. And on the way back, our train was 2 minutes late getting into London, and they could not have apologized any more profusely than they did. It here in the US, if a train is like maybe 30 hours late, they might acknowledge the fact that it wasn't close to on time. But otherwise, it, you know, like a train that's 25 minutes late is considered awesome here. And that's not that awesome, I got to be honest. And it was very refreshing to see the standards that you know, the European trains are held to. And they really, I mean, they were quite nice about it.
Oh, I remember when I took I remember when I was last in Paris, their trains are cool. And the because I we took the people that I went with, we took the train to Euro Disney, which I don't know if you did that. You probably didn't have time to. The Euro Disney is also kind of cool because, you know, because Europe, you know, most people speak English. So the thing is, even though it's in Europe, a lot of people speak English, so you can navigate your way around there. And I thought it was an interesting variation on the Disney versus, you know, the ones here in the U.S., either Disneyland or Disney World, which I also love to death. But the thing I remember is being on the train and all of a sudden we saw like the train cops. I think almost all public transportation, but especially in Europe, is kind of the honor system. Is it's an open platform, you can get on, but if they ask you for your ticket and you don't have it, you're in big trouble.
Oh yeah, of course. Oh yeah, you're talking about the metro, or you took like an above ground train?
Well, in Paris, when I was in Paris, on their high speed train, city, you know, we just hopped on and then all of a sudden we saw the train cops coming, and it was like a pretty formidable gang of people. Like, it wasn't just like one person, it was like a gang, and it was like, you know, they were like, you better have your ticket or you're in serious trouble, dude.
But
also
almost,
European
I
think
Versailles,
the
we would have taken, you know, that similar train, but it just, we just didn't.
Right. I think the world class trains, though I understand France has some nice high. No, I think you commented on this. I think you were on one of the higher speed trains.
We were on. Yeah, it was this thing. Lisa booked this trip to. It was a tour package to go to Liverpool and like do all the Beatles-y stuff, because we're all Beatles fans, as I mentioned earlier. But it wasn't really a tour. It was more like a package deal where you got, you know, your round trip train tickets, and then you got entrance into this Beatle Museum in Liverpool, and then you got this bus tour there. But there was no, like, when we got on the train, we were on our own to sort ourselves out for the day and make sure we got on the right train coming back. And it was cheap. It was cheaper to buy this tour package that got us a couple of these other things with it than it would have been to just buy regular, you know, coach train tickets. And they gave us the train tickets, and we realized they were first class tickets, and they were on Virgin's trains. This was one of these, what's it called? The Pendolino train is the model. This thing was amazing. I mean, it was so nice. It was such a pleasure to be on this train, especially when we realized we were stupid on the way down. We didn't even or the way over to Liverpool. We didn't realize we had first class tickets. So we sat in coach because they told us we had coach seats, and they told us which seats were reserved. On the way back, I'm looking, I'm like, this is first. I'm going to ask. And when I asked, and they're like, yeah, of course, right here, sir. I'm like, great.
Wow.
Fed us a meal. It was outstanding. So, yeah, Richard Branson knows how to do it, man.
Oh, yeah, Virgin. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I would say the best I've had in this country, Dave, the Acela, which is the somewhat high-speed line that runs on what they call the Northeast Corridor, which is pretty much between D.C. and
Boston.
I would say Boston.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good train, and even the regular class is good. It only reaches the maximum speed, which I think is 150 miles an hour, I think, in parts of Rhode Island. The other is just because our infrastructure sucks.
You're right. That's right. But yeah, we were doing about 125 miles an hour on the train. We clocked it with our iPhones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I've done that too. Actually, I've done that on our MTA train. There, you can get GPS apps, and as long as you can get a GPS. But I think for the most part, the trains that I take to Manhattan and back, the fastest I've seen them go is about 70 miles an hour, which, hey, it's faster than the traffic that is sitting there moving at 0 miles an hour. So,
right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All right. So we'll wrap that segment up. If you have any questions, you know, we did a lot of research. A lot of you helped with that research, but we're obviously always happy to pay that forward. So if anybody has any questions, feel free to, you know, send them in to us. feedback@mattkeekab.com.
I heard a thunder a boomer or something, Dave. I didn't quite hear you. I think you said feedback@mattkeekab.com.
I said feedback@mattkeekab.com, and I'm excellent. Glad that I got the right thing, because I do a lot of different podcasts now, and I am truly out of practice. At 2 weeks of not doing any of the normal things that I do. Like, it was weird playing drums a little bit this morning and that sort of thing. But I got it. If you don't want to send us an email, though, you can call us at 224-888-GEEK, which, John, is?
4-3-3-5. But Dave, from what I understand and what I've seen in our, not our feedback, because we don't have a feedback address.
Or do we?
Well, if you've listened to us, you may be able to figure that out. But the thing is, Dave, you can also SMS that number. And I actually replied to one or two SMSs that we received. So if you know what an SMS is, which is basically a text message, you could text message us.
Awesome. I haven't even seen the text yet. I haven't gone through all the stuff that came in while I was gone.
I replied to one or two.
Awesome.
The only thing I got to say to people is that if you do not email us and you decide to use SMS or something like that, please, if you'd like a reply, please tell us how to reach you via email, because a lot of these messages, well, if you send us a message via means other than email, we may not know how to get back to you.
Well, we can SMS them back.
Well, that's what I did. So someone actually SMS'd me, about something, and at least the Google SMS offers a way where if you reply via email, it then translates that to an SMS to them. But I'm just saying to people is it doesn't hurt to let us know how to get back to you.
Sweet.
By an email address if you're not emailing.
All right. Well, we have a bunch of cool stuff found to go through here, John. But the first thing I want to do is talk about our sponsors a little bit. And our first sponsor for this episode is Other World Computing at MacSales.com. This is a company, they've been around longer than Mac Geek Gab, which is saying something, because we've got, we're well into our double digits now. But the reason they've been around so long is because they sell quality products, they stand behind what they sell, and most importantly, they understand what they're selling you. So if you need help deciding what to buy, they can help you. Oftentimes, their website is going to be able to answer those questions. But if it can't, you can just call them, and they will walk you through it because they understand the products. That also means once you get a product from them, if you have a problem with it, well, call them up. Good news, they understand what they sold you. So they're going to be able to help you with that. And if it's a problem with the product, obviously they're going to take care of that. And if it's a problem that you're having using the product, they're going to take care of that too, because that's how they work. These folks are customer service ninjas. They understand that every business is the customer service business, and they take care of you. If you are a Thunderbolt user, or if your Mac has Thunderbolt, I highly recommend their Thunderbolt dock. It's outstanding. It's got more ports than you could ever want. USB 3, HDMI, audio in and out, gigabit Ethernet. Awesome. And if you've got a MacBook, get their USB-C dock, because that's going to give you 5 USB 3 ports, gigabit Ethernet, an SD card reader, HDMI, audio in and out, and power. So you're charging your computer at the same time. And it comes in 3 colors, gold, silver, and space gray, right? So you got to check this out. Other World Computing at MacSales.com. Our thanks to Other World Computing for sponsoring this episode. Our second sponsor today is Barebones. Barebones Software at barebones.com. They make BB Edit. This is an app that I actually didn't use for the last 2 weeks, but that's only because I wasn't really spending any time at a computer for the last 2 weeks while we were traveling. But I've used it all day today now that I've been back. BB Edit is a text editor, and I know that doesn't sound sexy, but all you got to do is try it. Go download BB Edit from barebones.com and try some things. Like, try just pasting in some text. It'll tell you how many characters, how many words, how many lines. Try doing a multi-file find and replace. So throw a folder of documents at this thing and say, look, I want to go through and change this text to that text in here. Boom. It's going to take care of it for you. It can either do it automatically, or you can walk through each one as you would expect to do. Of course, if you're doing some coding, well, BB Edit's going to know. It just knows what language you're in, and it subtly highlights everything so that it makes it more visually appealing. It doesn't change the file, just changes it right there. If you want to compare two files, BB Edit has this awesome three-paned view where it shows you one on one side, one on the other, and at the bottom, it shows you what the differences are. One line at a time, you just start going through. And when you go to a line, it highlights those differences in the two documents that you're comparing. Makes life really, really easy. You got to check it out. Barebones.com. This is where you can go download a free trial. When you're ready to buy, it's $50. You got to check it out. Our thanks to Barebones for sponsoring this episode. All right, John. It's time for Cool Stuff Found. Now, this is one of those things where it's kind of a crazy thing to do as I'm trying to get my my bearings here because, well, there's...
I am too because, oh my gosh.
There's just so much to do, but we're going to start...
Well, also, you've been hearing, if I disappear, it's because our severe thunderstorm seems to have just started.
Yeah,
I'm seeing lights and I'm hearing noise.
Are you getting the flashing lights?
Yes. Oh, lightning, good. Thunder. Yeah, I don't know if you can hear that. You can probably hear the thunder a bit, but
I heard a little bit. I wasn't sure if it was here or there because we've been, like I said, we had our lightning about 10 minutes before we started the show. So,
right. If I disappear, it's probably because I lost my juice.
Yeah, or I did. It's either one of us. So,
okay. Right, but cool stuff found is always cool.
Let's go to Scott. Scott says, I wrote you a little while back about Menu Bar Stats 2, which I learned about from MGG. I told you about how I reached out to the developer of Menu Bar Stats 2 and explained how he made the app fully accessible to VoiceOver. I happened to see that he also develops an app called The Clock, which is the best world clock. I asked him about the level of VoiceOver compatibility, and he knew it wasn't accessible. Now he has made it accessible. The Clock is a world clock and calendar that lives in your Mac's menu bar. I like this app because it helps me manage my schedule by providing quick access to a calendar, events on the calendar, and a comprehensive world clock. So you got to check it out, and we will put a link to that in the show notes. Thank you very much, Scott, for sending that along. Good stuff. John, you found an app here. You want to tell us about iOS console?
Well, I didn't find it. Tell you who did find it is our good friend Allison Sheridan at the NoSillaCast podcast, because she sent me a question about this. So as most of you know, but if you don't, there is an application on OS X or Mac OS now or in the future called the console, which basically, when developers write software, they will often send little diagnostics or alerts or things to something called the console, which is basically a text output and diagnostic tool. The thing is, most users don't see this. Now, if you're on OS X, you can run this thing, called the console, which I believe is in Applications Utilities. I think they bury it there. But if you're on console, you'll see these messages. The thing is, iOS, even though it is OS X-like, doesn't offer a way to access the console. The console is very useful because, especially if you're troubleshooting and trying to figure out what's going on, the normal user interface of either iOS or OS X or Mac OS will not tell you what's going on, but the console will. It can be overwhelming, though, because sometimes it's overload. So anyways... she asked me, have you heard of this thing? So it's called iOS Console, and it's from a group called Lemon Jar. So it's lemonjar.com/iOS console. And it lets you access the console if you have an iOS device plugged in.
Sweet.
Now, the thing is,
you tried it. It works.
It works. The thing is, she asked me this. She's like, well, have you tried? And I'm like, well, I don't need to try it because I have something called iPhone Configuration Utility, which is something that Apple offers still, but it's been somewhat deprecated, which means that so it used to let you look at the iOS console if you had the device plugged in. It no longer does that because of just changes they made in iOS. Xcode gives you, if you have Xcode, you can look at some console stuff, but this utility lets you see it all. So Sweet. It's great. It's free. You can throw them some bucks and they make some other nifty software. So So thank you very much, Allison. For those of you that are trying to diagnose your iOS issues, Can't hurt to run this and check it out and see what's in the console.
Sweet. All right, moving to Ev. Ev writes, he said, tip for a large cloud storage. Dropbox is $75 a month for unlimited file storage. With a $75 plan, you get 5 Dropbox accounts. We have 3 network-attached storage devices, 3 NASs, each syncing to a different Dropbox account. We currently have 16 terabytes up on one of them. We use it for archiving out video footage back to 2006. It doesn't say it on their website, but you can call them to expand your Dropbox to your needs at no extra cost. It works great and is never down. I dug in. Thank you, Ev. I dug into this and I thought, well, wait, it's not $75 a month. It's $12.50 per user a month. And that's true. If you go to dropbox.com/plans, you will see that. But as Ev points out very astutely, there is a 5 plan minimum. So that's where you get $75. But that's not a bad deal if you need gobs.
You mean 5 user?
5, sorry. Yeah. 5. Yeah, exactly. Right.
Okay.
Yeah. No, that's just, yeah, that's correct. Thank you. So if you need gobs and gobs of storage, offline storage or cloud storage, I should say, this is one way to do it. When I was out at WWDC, I ran into Joe Workman, one of my favorite developers, because, well, I don't actually use any of his stuff, but he's a great speaker, and I always enjoy his presentations, even though he didn't give one there. Anyway, he showed me something called Lizzie Tape, and it's called Lizzie Tape because it looks like a lizard. But it's something he stuck to his iPhone. He had this thing on his iPhone. He pulled his iPhone out of his pocket with this little tape, you know, this what I'll call a sticker on the back of it. He didn't have any trouble pulling it out of his jeans. He put it down on a table, and I could not lift that iPhone off the table. And then he just reached down and popped the iPhone off. It's a bunch of tiny, tiny, tiny little suction cups that don't get caught on your, you know, on clothing or anything. But if you just put it straight down, you have to lift like you would with the suction cup kind of from the edge, and then it comes right back up. But very, very handy thing to have if you want to make sure when you put your phone down, it's not going anywhere. And it would hold it up, on a vertical surface as well. No problem. I could see it being handy in like on an airplane where my iPad's sliding around with a little turbulence. Just pop it and you're good to go. Actually, you could put it on the back of your iPad and stick it to the seat in front of you, and then you don't even have to worry about the tray table. You could put your food on the tray table if you're eating. So anyway, it's $6.99 for a Lizzie Tape cell phone sticker mount right there on Amazon. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. And thank you, Joe, for not only telling me about this, but showing it to us too. Very, very good. And another thing that looks kind of silly when you first get it and then becomes the most one of the most essential items you will have is something from Blue Lounge called the Cable Drop Multi. I got 2 of these things and I looked at them and thought, okay. And I showed one to my wife and said, are you interested in this? It's a little thing that sticks. It's a piece of plastic or rubber that you stick to either your desk or your nightstand or whatever. And it's just got 4 little slots for cables. Well, it holds them all day long so that when you go to grab your cable at night, it's right there. And you've got another cable right there for your iPad and another one right there for your watch. And when you're done charging, you pop it back in this little cable drop multi. You get 2 of them for $8.95 from Blue Lounge. Awesome, awesome thing. We've got them next to the beds. It's outstanding. Very, very, again, just one of those simple things that makes your life way easier. And it's, you know, you're not spending a fortune on it. So it's good stuff. Did you check this thing out, John?
My cables are pretty pretty organized.
Okay.
But once they get chaotic, then yes. No, I did the, I saw your post. Huh. Hey, it's good stuff, man.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at some point, you don't want the rat's nest.
No, no.
Although rats are cool.
Yeah, you just don't want the nest. No, and you know, it's a pain in the neck when you're going, like, I hate it at night when I'm going to find my cable and I've got to, like, fish around on the floor for the stupid thing to find it. Well, that this solves that problem, and very inexpensively. My son's, I actually don't even have one of these things because my son took the other one. So I'm using a different solution to solve the same problem, but the cable drop multi, it's simple. It's just simple. And that's what I like. You don't have to do anything crazy. You just stick it and put the cables on it and you're done. So John, you found something from the OtterBox folks.
Well, I found a bunch of things. So Dave, I went to this event called CE Week, and actually they have a sub event for normal civilians. So CE Week is typically for press and analysts and stuff like that, but they actually have a sub event where if you're not pressed or anything like that, you can get in as well. So if you're in the Manhattan area, you may want to check it out. I'm being very specific, Manhattan, not New York City, because it's in Manhattan.
Mostly.
It's 18th Street, where you and I have been to a lot of events. But here's one thing that really caught my eye, Dave. So it's from OtterBox. So, you know, I got to say that I really have not done much OtterBox stuff in the past. I think I had one of their cases in the past, and I honestly wasn't really thrilled with it. I applied it. It was. I think my problem was it was hard to remove from the device, which to me is a criteria for a case. Is that if you have to like get a crowbar to take it off, it may not be that great a case. So heads up to case makers, make it easy to put on, but also to take off, but also protect the device. But OtterBox has come up with something which, as far as I can tell, is very recent, and they gave me some to try out, and I have tried them out, Dave, and I can speak to them and say that they're pretty cool. So the first thing is the case itself. So OtterBox has come out with this new, what I'm going to call a case standard, called the OtterBox Universe, small UNI, capital Verse,
which
implies it's like all encompassing. And it kind of is, because what it is, Dave, it's a case platform. So a lot of cases, you apply the case and the case does what it does. This case, the intent here is to allow you to attach other devices. So it provides a standard, and OtterBox has worked with a number of, I'm going to dare say, world-class companies that offer cool accessories to come out with their accessories that apply, that will work with the universe case technology. And basically there's two parts of it. So one, the area surrounding the lens, they have standardized. So people that come out with lens accessories can do that. And people that have come out with accessories that connect to the lightning port, they have also standardized that connection. Pretty darn cool. So the case in and of itself, and also it's a pretty cool case. It was kind of funny because I kind of challenged the representative. I talked to him. I'm like, well, from how high could I drop my phone and not have it damaged? And he's like, I can't tell you that. I'm like, yeah, I know you can't. How about off the record? And he's like, I can't tell you that.
Still
I'm
not
like,
going to tell you.
But it still looks like a fairly, the case that I had, and I think I may retire, was the Apple leather case. And from what I can see of this case, it provides access to all the ports, and it looks fairly sturdy. So it's the iPhone 6 6S Universe case. Retail is $49.95. So that's the first part.
Okay.
And I can tell you some of the but then they also provided me with some goodies, and maybe I'll mention one of them and we can move on.
Okay.
Or maybe a couple of them. So then here's some of the accessories. So if you look at the page for this, you can see all the accessories. Here's the ones that they gave me, and I think are really cool. So one, and actually, Dave, you used this on your vacation here. They have an Olloclip 4-in-1 lens attachment.
Love the Olloclip.
For you guys that don't know, Olloclip is an awesome lens enhancement for the iPhone. The iPhone camera is awesome. And the lens is pretty awesome for being a teeny little lens, but sometimes it may not do everything you want. So there's this company called Olloclip that has a lens. And so they made a universe compatible 4-in-1 lens that attaches to the case. They gave me one of these. So it provides you with four lenses, wide angle lens, fisheye, which personally I don't use a lot. And then if you screw those off, you get both a 10X macro and a 15X macro, which basically means you can do super detailed close-up photos, way beyond what the phone itself can do.
That wide angle lens is cool. I took some pictures. I put them up on my Twitter and Facebook from the top of the Eiffel Tower. And man,
dude, really, if you're cool up stuff there, you need wide. I mean, wide angle just
It was great. We were there for sunset too. It just worked perfectly. Gosh, it was great. Yeah. Fun.
So that's the one attachment that I think is great. So it's special for this case. The retail is $79.95. And then the second attachment that I got, which also excited. So this is to me, the exciting part about making a case that will take attachments is, Dave, you know, a lot of us have really wanted to have a battery case.
Sure.
You know, I don't know about you when you were traveling. Actually, I'm curious once I finish babbling here. But I'm curious if you were able to get a day or so out of your battery in your various devices. The thing is, a lot of people find this a challenge. So the other thing this case does with the standardized case design and lightning attachment, the other thing that I was offered was something called the Polar Pro Power Pack. What is this, you ask? I'm going to tell you exactly. It's a battery pack. I'm trying to find the capacity here. I believe it's 2,100 milliamp hours.
It is. It's 2,100. Yep.
Okay. But it's a very well-designed power pack. So it fits into this case. It offers you 2,100 milliamp hours, which is enough to give you a full charge on a 6 or an iPhone 6 like I have. The design of the case is also very nice because it has four LEDs to tell you the capacity. The thing I like what they did is they also include a on-off switch on this case.
Yeah,
so,
that's good.
Which is good because a lot of cases, once you plug it into the accessory, it starts charging it. This one has a switch that lets you control that. So hats off to them as well. That item retails. Oh, did you? I think you just wiped it out.
All right.
No, I think it retailed for $49.95 for the Polar Pro Power Pack. So I think the Universe case is something to pay attention to for people who want a standardized case that lets you, like some of the things that I haven't tried yet. So, for example, the guys that make the smart card, the Square reader.
Yeah.
The OtterBox work with them. So if you want to plug a Square reader in and make that a, you know, temporary attachment, fantastic idea because,
it's smart.
Cases would be you apply the case and you're pretty much stuck with what that case does. OtterBox thought, well, why don't we make a case platform? And that's what they did. And it looks pretty cool.
Cool. Yeah. So I actually used a battery case. I'm using the iPhone SE. That's what I used when we traveled. It worked brilliantly. I really like the size of it because I was able to take pictures one-handed. We did a couple of Segway tours and all of that stuff. It's just great. But I suspected and was correct that the way I was going to use it, I would not get a full day out of the battery. And so my current favorite battery company is Tilt, T-Y-L-T. And it's because I've used their batteries for a long time. They are reliable. They actually charge the amount that they say they're going to charge. So many batteries. I'm not speaking necessarily about the OtterBox one. I haven't tested it. But lots of batteries that I have tested say that they have, 2,000 milliamps, 2,500. Some say they have 6,000. Some say they have 20,000. And then it turns out that, it's maybe, half or even a third the capacity that they're advertised. The Tilt stuff always is exactly what they say. And so I actually bought a power case, charging case for the iPhone 5, and it worked perfectly on the iPhone SE. And it was relatively cheap. I think I got it for like $30 or something at Amazon. And what's cool about it is that it's a two-piece thing. The battery part slides off, but you still have a case, a very, very thin case, around the phone to protect it when it's not in the battery. The battery does have a power button. So most days I just traveled with the phone in the battery case. And when I would get down to about 30%, I would charge the phone all the way up to the top and then turn it off. And I knew that I had like a little bit left if I needed, if I burned my battery down again, I knew I had a little bit left to, get an Uber or whatever I needed to do. Thankfully, it never came to, I never got quite that close. But once we'd come back to the apartment, hang out or whatever, and then when we were going to go out to dinner, I knew we weren't going to be out very, very long. So I would just take the phone without the battery case. And I lived that way for the last 2 weeks, and it was outstanding. Worked really, really well. And I was glad that the iPhone 5, version of this case worked great. So that's what I used. Right before I left, though, I learned about something that I didn't get until after I got back, but it's from Nomad, John, and I'd had it queued up to talk about here. It's their bifold leather wallet. Now that might sound like a silly thing to talk about in a battery segment, but I think you know where this is going. It's a bifold wallet with a battery pack at the end, and it's got a little cable in it that you can, you know, it's a lightning cable in the one that I've got here, and it plugs right in. And the nice part is it's a 2400 milliamp hour battery that they advertise. I literally opened this thing up this morning because I was gone all week. So I have not tested it yet. I mean, I've tested it to charge, but I haven't tested it enough to speak to the battery capacity. But it's, you know, it's a wallet that you were going to keep with you anyway. So I had hoped that I would be able to test this thing on my Europe trip, but the timing of their shipment just didn't work. I am a huge fan. The whole time I was in Europe, I brought three watch bands with me for my Apple Watch. I only used one. The other two actually are still in my backpack. I got to remember to take them out. The only one that I used was the Nomad strap. It's a leather strap. It's very, very comfortable. It looks classy enough to wear out to dinner. I've had this strap on my watch for a while, and it's worn in nicely, and it looks like a classy leather strap because it is a classy leather strap. And the wallet is made from similar soft leather. So it's really a handsome wallet. I like this thing. My next trip, I will definitely try this out.
Nice. Let me ask you a travel follow-up. Now, as some of you may know, but if you don't, if you're global, so the thing is, in the United States here, our alternating current that comes out of the wall is 120 volts, 60 cycles. Well, the thing is, I wanted to ask you this. So the thing is, in this country, we have 120 volts, 60 cycles. Other parts of the world have different standards for either the voltage or the frequency of the alternating current. And the thing is, I'm curious what you use. So for some things that are self-contained, it's not a worry. You know, you plug your battery pack into your iDevice and you're good.
It doesn't matter where my location is on the planet.
But if you need it to charge something, and I think for the most part, most Apple products, Apple power adapters, if you get an accessory kit, their adapters themselves will figure it out. You just have to get the right plug, and intentionally the countries use a different style plug, whether it's flat blade or round or whatever. But I'm just wondering. I mean, obviously you anticipated that you need different plugs, but I'm wondering what you used and your if you have any advice or how satisfied you were with what you did use. Did you use an Apple product or third party, or how did that work out?
Yeah. So I'm glad you asked this, because I should have included this in my tech, Europe notes that we talked about at the beginning of the show, and I didn't. So I looked at what I was going to be bringing with me and realized that everything had an adapting power, power adapter. It had a switching power adapter. And you can look at your power adapters, and all of your Apple ones will do this. And as long as it says that it does 110 to, 240 or whatever it says on there, that's fine. If it only says 110, then the power adapter cannot take more current than they provide, at least here in the U.S. But all the Apple stuff will take up to 240. It's fine. As you said, you need to get an adapter. Now, there's two different types of adapters. One is just truly just an adapter to make it so that your plug will fit into whatever the outlet shape is in the country you're in, but it does not do any power conversion. And that's what I used. I actually bought a bunch of them from ricksteves.com. Rick Steves has a lot of great stuff for travel, including some great travel books for different cities that we actually used. But these adapters, I mean, I think for $14 I got four adapters for UK and then four adapters for EU, which was enough for the family. It shipped to me. And it was, like I said, it was like, I don't know, it was less than $15 for all eight adapters. And of course we needed different ones. Barcelona and Paris were the same. UK was different. UK has those weird flat blades, and they're all, I mean, they're not weird, they're just different. And it worked great. For my MacBook Air, I already had a PlugBug World, which is a cool little adapter that basically takes the place of the plug adapter on your power brick for your laptop. And so I had that with me, and that came with all the right adapters. But again, it's really the Apple power adapter that's doing the hard work. And so that allowed us to charge everything. It was almost a non-issue. You just had to, you know, like I said, pick the right adapter, plug into the outlet, good to go. And it just worked. I mean, I was nervous the first time in London when I plugged in. I'm like, am I going to blow things up? I had an Anker 10-port USB charger with me that I always travel with. And that had a switching power supply in it. So again, I just had to put the right adapter on it, and I turned it on. The blue light came on. Nothing smoked. Plugged my iPad in. Good to go. And that was it. All set. So,
okay. Oh, I see. PlugBug is a, yeah. Okay. 12 South. Yeah.
Yeah.
They got me one of those as well. So that is a fine option. I think it's reasonably priced. Apple also sells an adapter kit, if you want that, but I think it's actually more expensive.
Way more expensive. Yeah. Yeah.
So 12 South, I think we agree is the way to go. If you're do a lot of world travel and you want,
You don't, but you really don't need, I mean, I don't get me wrong. I love the folks at 12 South, and the PlugBug is cool. I use it all the time, even in the US, because it adds a USB port to your power adapter.
Right.
So when you've got like one outlet, you can plug in and still charge USB as well as that. So I like it, but your normal Apple adapter would work just fine with one of these things from Rick Steves. So it's just, you know, I mean, it, or, and you could get them from Amazon or whatever. I just found Rick Steves to be the least expensive. Again, these are like cheap pieces of plastic that have different, you know, you plug your metal prongs into one end of it and its metal prongs plug into the outlet. That's all. That's all it does. Yeah.
And I got to say, Dave, hats off to Apple is that I think it was probably 3 to 6 months ago, I got an email from Apple because I had bought one of their older adapter kits and they were like, yeah, we kind of had a recall because some of them may like burn the house down or something. So, this thing that you bought like 6 years ago or 8 years ago, we're going to swap out those for ones that won't burn the house down.
Oh,
and I'm
good.
Like, no, Apple is, you know, in a lot of cases, I mean, that's why we love Apple. I mean, I can't believe that they actually dug back like almost a decade for something I bought and said, you know, we're going to swap it out.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I guess also because they don't get their asses sued, right?
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, that's totally. Yeah.
But apparently there was a manufacturer, intermittent manufacturing defect in the adapter, which could cause it to short out and make bad things happen. So,
yeah, absolutely. All right. So we've got some stuff to go through. We're never, as always, we're not going to get through everything. I did want to share one more thing that, that I noticed from traveling, but it's also just kind of cool stuff found. TiVo added, to their Bolt, which is their newest one. And then of course their Romeo also has this too, out of home streaming. And I was actually kind of, excited about being able to stream, like, you know, having my TiVo continue to record stuff while we were gone. And if we were, you know, just chilling out at night, if I wanted to watch a show from home, I could. And I knew they had added it to the Bolt, and I knew we had the software update on the Bolt, and I had the latest version of the TiVo app on my iPad. Awesome. I get to London. I'm like, oh, let me see how that works. And I start it up, and it says, oh, you haven't enabled out-of-home streaming on your TiVo Bolt. I'm like, okay, let's do that. Like, well, you have to be on the same network as your TiVo Bolt to turn this on, and then you can use it when you're not there. And I'm thinking, you know, where does that make sense? Why would that, like, I would never try to stream at home because I'm sitting on the couch. And I get that some people will try to stream at home and it works, you know, in the house. And then you would get the warning that you had to do this. But I don't even know that you would get the warning that you had to do this if you tried it in your house. But, and so I VPN'd in. I'm like, aha, I know how to skin this cat, right? Nope, I don't, evidently, because VPNing back into the house didn't help that problem. It's like, yeah, you're still not actually on the same Wi-Fi network. So, you know, no, you can't do it. So I couldn't do it. I mean, I could have called a friend to come over and like log into our TiVo account and do all the right crazy things and stand in my house and flip this switch. But no, I just said, fine, I'm really not in Europe to watch American TV anyway. I can do that in America. And we didn't really use that. If we wanted to watch something, we just streamed it from the disc station or from Netflix or whatever. When I got home, though, I thought, aha, I should turn this on so that I have this capability. It took like 4 seconds to enable this. Why I had to be, I get there's probably some licensing thing or whatever.
It's a DRM. Yeah, I'm sure it's a licensing or DRM silliness.
But I wish the app like would have warned me when it did this, like, hey, you now have out-of-home streaming. You should enable this right away now while you're thinking about it and at home, because otherwise you're going to be sad Dave later. And so I don't want any of you to be sad Dave or sad insert your name here. So if you're using TiVo, just launch the app while you're home. Go into the settings. It's not obvious. You got to go into settings, go into streaming, click the options button, and then it'll come up and there'll be the little checkbox for out of home streaming. You just tap that and it says, you promise not to be naughty about this. And you're like, yeah. And then everything's good. So, but then you get like, it's like a sling box because you can stream stuff that the TiVo has recorded and you can stream stuff that, that's on live TV. So it, you get like all this great capability, but, you just got to flip the, you know, just the one little switch, but you have to be right here to do that. So I was, and then I did it, and now I feel happier about it, I guess. I don't know. What else do we have here?
I can give you a tidbit, Dave.
Give me a tidbit.
Follow-up.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you a little tiny tidbit here. Dave, we didn't intentionally, but we kind of lied. So you and I were under the impression that Time Machine backups do not include any sort of checksum or verification that the data in the backup is the same as the data on the source.
Yeah.
We were wrong, Dave.
What?
How did I? I'm going to tell you, brother, and I can tell you how you can find out this information right now. So I was just surfing through the man pages. What are man pages, people ask? Man pages. So
pretty it's much a manual any version, page.
Pretty much any version of Unix has something called a man page. And if you type man, a space, and then the name of the command, it'll blurt out information about that command and tell you how to use it in detail from the command line or the console or no, the terminal. Dave, I found this thing. So Time Machine, as of 10.11, has an option called verify checksums.
Okay.
Now, both you and I are going to be like, what?
Okay, where do I get this option?
Well, if you type man space tmutil, you're going to see a list of options. Dave, the option is called verify checksums, and I'm not going to read the entire thing to you here, but it says in the end of the description for that command, beginning in OS 10.11, Time Machine records checksums of files copied into snapshots. Checksums are not retroactively computed for files that were copied by earlier releases of OS 10.
Okay.
I just thought this was intensely interesting because we were under the impression that Time Machine backups did not have any sort of redundancy or checksums. As it turns out, it sounds like Apple kind of sneakily added this in 10.11, at least based on what the man page says. And I even ran this command from my terminal,
yeah,
and it came up with nothing. It basically, if there's nothing wrong, it'll say, eh.
Right. Right. No, no output is generated for matching checksums. And then,
okay, so, you
right.
found it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No,
but
yeah.
I just want to mention this because I was as surprised as anyone. Now, I don't believe that this is invoked. As far as I can tell, the only way to do this is to do it from the terminal.
Okay.
I don't believe that if you say verify backup, this happens. Maybe it does. I don't know. We should actually, if we have any Apple geniuses or Apple gurus or anybody inside Apple that added this feature, because honestly, Dave, I don't think... somebody Apple is slacking off here. You guys got to let us know that this is happening, okay?
Huh.
All right, I was not aware that this, I just saw this and I'm like, when did this happen? So
I wonder if this is a bit of a peek into
yes.
what's going on with the new file system that Apple's putting together, right? APFS. So this verify, because Time Machine is going to have to change, if not from a user experience standpoint, from an engineering under the hood standpoint, it has to change dramatically for the new file system. And that's a good thing. So I wonder if this is preparing for that by generating checksums so that when the file system is moved over, it's got this stuff and it can do it. And then who knows, maybe a future incarnation of Time Machine will actually verify these. I just quickly looked in my console logs here on my Mac, and I searched for both backup D, which shows me all of the stuff and it that backup D does, and it says nothing about verifying. And I searched for checksums and got zero. So I don't think it's doing this automatically. I think it's only doing it on demand from the command line. So, yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, interesting. But I'm with you. I think it's a segue to what we're going to see in the next OS.
That's great. Nice catch, man. Very cool. That's very cool.
Look at hey, anybody who's listening, if you have time to kill, look at the man pages. You may find something that will surprise you. No, I certainly did. I was just like, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's pretty cool. All right. So let's, we've got a ton of tips and follow-ups from last week, and really we don't have time to go through any of it. I do want to go to Bob because this is actually a cool stuff found here. Bob rewinds us back a little ways to Mac Geek Gab 600, where he says, you mentioned wanting more alerts. You might want to look at an app called Alarmed by Yachtoville. And he says, this is for iOS. It has a locations reminders feature, aka geofencing. Basically, you give an address and it sets a pin. You can then specify if it should send you an alert when you arrive or when you leave that location. One of the nice features, you get to choose a specific alarm sound from an app provided list. This way you can easily tell if it is coming from Alarmed and not yet another generic alert. You can have a long list of location-based alerts for different things you should do when you are near a specific location. Beyond that, Alarmed is a nice time-based reminder system where you can have saved countdown timers for various tasks that need to be checked in N minutes. So thank you for that, Bob. This is a handy little app. I like geofences. You know, I used to be sort of against the concept of geofences because it meant that something was always sort of paying attention to your location. And that, of course, meant that your battery would be used more. But since so many things on our iOS devices, it's impossible to operate an iOS device these days without something always looking at your location, at least for me. I want to get weather alerts from where I am. I like dark sky to tell me, or storm, either one of them, to tell me that it's going to rain, you know, or that rain was detected within X number of miles of my location, that kind of thing. It's really handy. And I like it, as I said earlier in the show, I like DS Photo to back up my photos when I just get home. That requires a location-based geofence. So now that I've given up on trying to limit my phone's location, you know, the time that it is tracking my location, my life is actually better. So it's good stuff. And, you know, you can do it for your home kit stuff and all that stuff. So very, very cool. Thank you, Bob. I like that stuff. I'm trying to think if there's anything else that we should go through here. And I'm not convinced that there is. We've got a lot of tips. Go ahead, John. What do you want?
No, I don't know. I got a pile of hardware, but
we all do. Actually, tell us about this Tattoo thing that you got, John.
I'm going to tell you about that. All right. So Tattoo, I'm not sure of the exact pronunciation here. So this is a company that I met at, you know, this show as well. So they make something called Smart AC Control. Now, what is that? All right. Well, again, I'm going to try to be concise here, Dave. Okay. I know it goes against my nature. All right. What is this device? It's a little box. It controls your air conditioner, but it controls your air conditioner. So my household and many households, so I have thermostats only for my heating system. I do not have central air conditioning. I have two window air conditioners. They're actually older Fetters units. They're somewhat Energy Star, great stuff. And they're controlled by an infrared remote. Okay, that's great. But the thing is, they're kind of stupid. The thing is, you either have to be there to turn them on or off, or they have a very rudimentary timer feature saying, okay, turn on at this time, turn off at that time. Well, that may not be, you know, very energy efficient, right?
Oh, dude. Well, what if yeah.
Now you look at this device. All right. So what these guys did, so they're a German company. And of course, you know, Germans, I'm German or I have German background. I mean, this is the epitome of German engineering. So what this is a box. So it has a number of things in it. So one, it has an IR receiver and transmitter. Why? Because what you do is you train it to talk to your air conditioner.
Sure.
It basically,
or if you have to, right? I mean, they've got a database of stuff, but you can train it if you're
stuck in the database.
Yeah.
Mine was old enough where I had to train it. But the thing is, they have the IR codes, like a lot of other products, to provide certain levels of control. Now, for my particular air conditioner, it's basically on, off, and set the temperature. Actually, it's funny. The way they do this is actually kind of clever. So they record this.
Does it work with HomeKit, John?
It will.
Okay.
I actually looked this up. They have the chip. They have not enabled it, but it will work with HomeKit sometime next year.
Okay, but you can do it.
That excites me.
You can.
So
do
they
it
have an app
your,
for now.
From your app. Okay, got it.
Right. So here's what it does. So the box itself will turn your AC on and off. They offer an iOS app. You can schedule when to turn it on or off, or you can manually control it, which is pretty awesome. The other thing it provides for me, Dave, which is awesome, is it provides me the temperature and humidity where the device is located. Hey, now I know what's happening, at least in the first floor of my house. I didn't used to because I'd never had any smart devices.
Sure.
So that's another cool part. The other cool part is it has, you were talking about this, geofencing. The thing is, if you give it your address, and you're running the app on your iOS device, though they also, so hats off to them. So two things here. So let me roll back. So it has geofencing. So the thing is, if it's like, oh, John is X number of feet away from home, gee, I probably shouldn't have the AC on because he's not here. Let me turn it off. And then when you get close to home, it'll turn the AC back on. What's the benefit?
Well, energy. I mean, it's just it's just like HomeKit. I mean, but that's smart. And Ecobee and Nest and all of those. Yeah, do that.
And
too.
It's funny because a friend of mine, my good buddy Kenny, and I don't think you haven't met Kenny. But anyways, Kenny was like, well, this just what the Nest does. And I'm like, well, yeah, but the thing is, my household is not equipped to fully utilize a Nest. So this is...
No, your AC wouldn't work with a Nest.
Yeah, because my thermostat doesn't control my AC. Yeah. So the thing is, for people that have window air conditioners that are controlled by a handheld remote, this is a great solution.
Let me rewind that. It's not just window air conditioners. It's any air conditioner that's controlled by a remote. Because I don't have a window air conditioner in the studio here. I have what's called a mini split where I have a compressor outside, and then I have the coil inside here sitting on a wall. It's essentially ductless central air, but I just have a remote that sits right next to me, and I have to, you know, turn it on when I come in the studio and turn it off. Now, thankfully, it's a pretty powerful, it's overpowered for the room, so it doesn't take very long. And the same is true of the office. It's a dual zone thing, and it actually works great. But it would be really nice to be able to control this from remote or program it in a way that's a little more intelligent than having to touch a button on the remote. Yeah.
Right. I like these guys because
smart.
The underlying engineering, and then we'll move on. But the underlying engineering.
You said you were going to be concise about this, by the way.
I believe we're
on the 5-minute mark for this one. So,
but I want to indicate the benefit here. So they have an iOS app, and the thing is, people that only offer an iOS app to control your smart home devices, I shake my fist at you. These guys, if you want to log in to their website and view the app, it looks exactly the same, which, dude, to me is engineering well, so brilliance.
Because you haven't experienced it, Nest and Ecobee work the same way. You can go to a website without the app. And
my fish shake is Wink. I have some Wink bulbs and I have a Wink
app. Are they out of business?
They had some financial issues, but they're still around. But the thing is, the only way I can control my Wink bulbs, Dave, is through the iOS app. There is no web interface. So, So you make a good point, but these guys did it right. The engineering is, I can do it either through the web and see the same interface, or I can run the iOS app, but it's cool. So it's smart. It has, you know, geofencing, and so the retail is $179. Some people say, well, you know, that's kind of pricey, but the thing is, if your device isn't running when you're not there and it saves you money, hey,
that's
just like
a
Nest, right?
Well, it's more than just the environmental impact. It's just the convenience of being able to control it when you're not there. I mean, for me, there are times when I walk into the studio or into the office, and it's like, oh, crap, yeah, I left the AC on all night. Why? I mean, it wouldn't have known that I was far away because it's all the same network or whatever.
Right.
But it's like, and plus, if I could just set a schedule for the thing to, no matter what, turn off at 8 p.m.,
would
be handy. Yeah.
And to me, the big plus is now I have a device that tells me, at least on the first floor of my house, the temperature and humidity. Because that's one thing that
this
does, no matter what.
When they enable HomeKit stuff, that's when it gets fun. Because now, not only is that device controllable, it now becomes a trigger because it's feeding information into HomeKit, and that's a good thing. So,
yes, sir. And I hear the band.
Yeah,
I guess they survived the storm.
They did. They did. So, yeah, that was a 7-minute concise segment from you, my friend. So, just so you know,
I'm getting better.
Sure. visit us on Facebook at facebook.com/groups/MacGeekGab, or if you want to just be simple about it, go to MacGeekGab.com/Facebook. That'll bring you to the same place. We've got a great group of folks, us included, that, I answer as many questions as I ask there. It is a great community, an awesome resource, and I really encourage you folks to get involved. It just makes the community even better when you're there, but I think I didn't look. It looks like we're about to top 1,000, I thought. There's a lot of people there. So and everybody's paying attention. It's great, great stuff. And a
it's cray cray.
It's
great. I constantly get notifications. Hey, somebody wants to join your Facebook group.
I'm you never approve them. I was doing it while I was in
Europe. What are you talking about? I approve them all the time, yo.
Oh, you do? Okay. All right. Maybe I don't get the notification when you approve them. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, anybody who's part of the group can approve anybody else.
That's
right?
Correct. Yes, that's right. Yeah. It's not.
I don't know if you and I only get the notifications because we're the owner of the group, but
I don't think so. I think everybody does. Yeah. No, it's good, and everybody. I know it's not just me that approves them. Everybody does. Because I'll see the notification, and then sometimes I'll go check in like 20 minutes, and it's like, oh, it's already approved. It's good. Done. Which is good. Good stuff. I want to thank our sponsors for this show. I want to thank, of course, Otherworld Computing and Barebones Software. Otherworld Computing at maxsales.com and Barebones Software at barebones.com. I want to thank CacheFly at CacheFly.com because they provide all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. And, of course, the sponsors in our podcast marketplace, Gazelle.com. Smile at smilesoftware.com/geek. Squarespace at squarespace.com/mgg. And Casper at casper.com/mgg. Coupon code MGG saves you $50. Well, folks, it is a pleasure to be back. I hope I hope I was able to record this show properly because it's weird not doing. I mean, we've been doing this straight for 11 years to take 2 weeks off. That's definitely the longest stretch. So I'm hoping that I didn't or you didn't get caught.
Made up.